much. Down for loading up on donuts to help with steering capability in the back. But do keep them in there in your prayers. So Lambert, thanks for being with us this morning. We're in Genesis.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Genesis chapter
36.
Okay, now let's see if you get the page number right. Page 34. Page 34. All right. This is a kind of a major change in the narrative here. But remember, from chapter 35, some of the things that have been happening. Our family under Jacob has come from northern Iraq, and after hanging out 20 years with their relatives, including Uncle Laban. The family under Jacob has now come on down into Israel, and they settle in a town called Shechem, which is north of Bethel, which is north of Jerusalem a little bit, and they stay there 10 years. No, I'm trying to catch you. You're all asleep. No, there's a terrible massacre there in which Dinah's two brothers wipe out all the men in the village for a little indiscretion on the part of the Shechemites, who have decided that Dinah should marry into their family over there. Anyway, leaving rather hastily, Jacob comes down to next stop, Bethel, about 30 miles, less than that, 20 miles south of Shechem, and he puts a pillar up there and puts oil on the pillar. And what does that symbolize? When the patriarchs stop, put up a pillar, maybe, what is it? What are they doing?
Honoring God.
It's an honoring to God. It's a kind of recommittal, rededication time, a memorial, a monument. And Bethel is a favorite stopping place. It's been there since Abraham. What's the name Bethel mean? House of God. Okay. So now after hanging out who knows how long at Bethel, the caravan, this includes men, women, and children, and zillions of animals, which is sheep, goats, and cattle, they head where next? Up to Jerusalem and then towards Bethlehem. Something happens on the way to Bethlehem.
Rachel
dies. Who is she?
Jacob's wife.
The favorite wife. And what are the circumstances of her death?
Childbirth.
And who does she give birth to?
Benjamin.
That he becomes the last of the 12 sons, 12 family boys in the family of Israel. Okay, this is terribly sad. This is the sad time, and then we're going to find out there's one other sad thing that happens right along up in that part of town with
Reuben.
Who's Reuben?
Firstborn.
Okay. He's about 30, about now. And something happens in his life that shouldn't have.
He slept with his father's concubine.
He got into an affair with his father's concubine. His mother has just died. This may be how he's working on the grieving process, is to talk to his other mother. The stepmother, who is the handmaiden of his mother. And they get into a little escapade of sex. And the news gets to the family. Is this going to cost him anything? What do you think it might cost him? We're not going to see the consequence right away, but what do you think it could?
His birthright.
He's the firstborn. Maybe he will lose his birthright. So let's wait until that comes up in the text. And then at the close of chapter 35, we have a listing of the 12 sons again. Now chapter 36. These are the descendants of Esau. I have a little question here at this point. Who wrote the five books of Moses by Moses? Moses wrote the five books of Moses. So this is written by Moses. How do we, one reason why we know that or think that it's Moses that wrote these? Well, Jesus, for one, quotes from all of these books and attributes them to Moses. There's plenty of internal evidence. Now, are there any clues in the construction of Genesis that show where the source material came from? Did Moses have this big warehouse full of clay bricks when he sat down to write the five books of Moses, since he wasn't born yet? And he sits down and deciphers these clay bricks. Is that how it happened? Or did he have giant scrolls? Oh, he had a scribe, or a whole bunch of scribes that came and dictated it to him?
No.
We don't really know, do we? Except that we do know something about how Genesis is put together. Remember, Genesis is made up of some documents, and you can tell when one document ends and another one starts. And the clue is always the little phrase, "These are the descendants of." That means this is the diary of. Okay? Chapter 1 of Genesis, who do you suppose wrote that or takes credit for it? Well, God would. There's nobody else there to write that. And who takes the credit for the next chunk of Genesis? Adam. And so now who do you suppose has been writing the part we've been reading here up until chapter 36? Who's likely to be writing it?
Jacob.
Jacob, okay. Now, Jacob and Esau are still on good terms. They haven't parted company. They talk to each other. As a matter of fact, their dad hasn't died yet. It says in the previous chapter that he died, but that's just looking ahead a little bit. So they get together at his funeral, for example. So chapter 36 is very likely written by Esau. That's what it says. These are the descendants of Esau. Esau, that is Edom. So probably Esau came down with this long list of family members, and he handed it to his brother, and he said, "Oh, by the way, since you're writing up all this document, here's my side of the family." It's pretty complete. That sort of make okay. So we're going to have this little chunk in here is going to be something that Esau wrote. Now, I don't know any other way to explain this, because there's a lot of names. How did we get this? We could have got them right from God. These are the descendants of Esau, that is, Edom. Esau took his wives from the Canaanites. Is that cool?
No,
it's not cool. But on the other hand, Esau is the man of the world who renounces the spiritual inheritance of his parents and becomes an example for us of the man who walks according to the flesh his whole life long. And he accumulates great wealth, and he has a lot of wives and children who are all from the married out of the local tribes. Okay, and here he took his wives from the Canaanite. So he has several wives: Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite; Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the son of Zibeon the Hivite; Basemath, Ishmael's daughter. Who's Ishmael?
Abraham's
son by Hagar, who likewise doesn't inherit the promises. It's a separate covenant with him. And he becomes the father of the Arabs, the tribes of Arabia.
Great uncle,
okay. We have Ishmael's daughter, the sister of Debaeth, and Ada bore to Esau Eliphaz. Basemath bore Reuel, and Aholibamah bore Jeush, Jalem, and Korah. These are the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. A long list of names, verse 6, Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the members of his household, his cattle, all the beasts and all the property which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and he went into a land away from his brother Jacob. There's the record that they're going to split company, and Esau is going to go where? Where's Edom? In fact, It's South Jordan. South Jordan, down around the end of the Dead Sea. And it will be important all the way till the second coming of Christ. Actually, that part of the world will be. And the main reason at this point for their separation isn't their differences in belief. It's the same thing that happened with Lot and Abraham. Their flocks are multiplying, and they're competing for the same grazing space. And the rule about grazing space is they have to graze in between the Canaanite villages. Wherever there's a Canaanite village belongs to that local Canaanite family, and you can only graze where there's corridors in between. And so it's not exactly free grazing land everywhere. So they went into a land away from Jacob. Their possessions were too great for them to dwell together. The land of their sojournings would not support them because of their cattle. So Esau is being blessed, even though he's renounced his birthright, and he's renounced his father's religion. Esau dwelt in the hill country of Seir. That's another name for that territory. And Esau is Edom. And what does the word Edom mean?
Red.
Okay. These are the descendants of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. They're the names of Esau's sons. We started with his immediate family. Now we go down to his offspring. These are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau; Reuel, the son of Basemath, the wife of Esau; and so on and so on. And I'll read you, I'll just jump down, and verse 15 says, these are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esau, the chiefs, Teman and Omar and Zepho and Kenaz and Korah and Gadam and Amalek. Some of these names you'll remember because they come up later in the Bible during time of the conquest, and they're still biblical names. King James, anybody have a King James here? It says the Dukes of Edom.
Yeah.
Who are the Dukes of Edom in this list here? We've got immediate family of Esau, then we've got his sons and their families, and then we've got another, the Dukes. Patriarchs. we don't have dukes today, do we?
Wasn't there a TV show about the Dukes?
Dukes
of Hazzard.
Dukes of Hazzard.
Sorry.
Okay. Are there any Dukes in Milpitas or Dukes in Hazzard? Okay. So.
Show your age, babe.
All right. The Dukes run on down. Verse 31. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. That's just saying they've been there a long time. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, the name of the city being Dinhaba. Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his stead, and so on and so on. And so there's the list of the three generations. And at this end of this chapter is the last mention of Esau. He just goes away, prospers, and all of his descendants prosper. Now, I wonder why this is important other than giving a little credit to Esau. So that I wonder if there's any significance. Now, because the people of Israel are going to leave the land, because remember God told Abraham that they're going to be gone for 400 years. And why are they gone for 400 years? Because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Who are the people that are living in the land when Abraham comes in? Canaanites. Who are they descended from? Grandson of Ham. And what are they noted for? They're noted for their lifestyle, their lousy, immoral lifestyles, very permissive with regard to sexuality and child sacrifice and degraded cultural values. Just a real degenerate bunch of people, all of them are. So it poses a problem for the people of Israel when they come into the land to not intermarry and not mix in with these people, the Canaanites, who are already living there. Their lifestyle, which passes on from father to son, is degenerated, and it gradually gets worse. Do these people know who God is? Yes, they do. Have they had a chance to turn to the God of Israel? Yes. Do any of them turn to God at all?
No.
Some few. Yeah. Like, for example, a prostitute at
Rahab,
the prostitute at Jericho.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Ruth,
the Moabitess. Okay, now 400 years go by, and the people of Israel are gone from the land, and they come back, and now what do we have as far as culture? Now we've got the Canaanites are still there, and they have intermarried and mixed with the Edomites and the Ishmaelites. So we're going to get a cultural mix that is thoroughly pagan, thoroughly corrupt, thoroughly degenerated, informed about God, but having rejected God. The worst place you'd ever want to go live.
I wonder if, as Moses is writing this, it's to tell the children coming out of Egypt where they came from.
Yep.
If perhaps this chapter isn't a picture of where you end up without God, without the grace that they're chosen as his people, maybe that's part of the reason.
Oh, I think so. I think so. To get the people of Israel to appreciate the tremendous subculture God has given them, their family values and their integrity and their heritage. The land belongs to them and they got to take it. And the great danger of intermixing with these thoroughly pagan tribes. And this is a dangerous place. You could say the gene pool's all mixed up now, and it's gotten much, much worse in 400 years. Much more degraded. It's degraded like the peninsula here, like Palo Alto and like the Bay. All right? So that gives us the background. Now, chapter 37. Jacob dwelt in the land of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. This is the history of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, where does he come in the 12 sons? Number 11. And he's got a little brother, Benjamin, who's just been born. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a lad with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought an ill report of them to their father. Okay, they're all out taking care of the sheep and the goats and the cattle many miles from where their father happens to be staying. He's old. And what do you suppose the bad conduct was? There aren't any saloons around where you can go get drunk. They not a lot of things that boys like to do that are harmful, destructive, immoral, out there in the middle of nowhere. What do you think? They're just young teenagers, and they have the responsibility of taking care of these huge herds. We're not told, so you have to just guess. What do you think? Their brother goes to dad and says, "Hey, my little brothers are messing up out there in the desert."
Lazy,
probably. Yeah, being careless so that that sheep get killed by bears and lions and fall over a cliff. Sheep take a lot of care, right? Any other ideas?
Now, Jacob is wealthy at this point, right?
So yeah.
Might they be afflicted with a sense of, well, we don't really need to be diligent in our work. He's got enough. What's one or two or three?
That's exactly right. God has prospered Jacob and family. They're very, very wealthy, and they have good reason to. They've been told that this is a dangerous land with the Canaanites all around them who are their enemies. Now they're in the back.
I'm just thinking sometimes we have 4-H and there's sheep and animals, and they like, if they're being mischievous, they want to run the animals. And that runs off the weight, and sheep especially with their coat can get really too warm, overheat.
Yeah. If you overrun animals, particularly in the heat of summer, drive them too hard, they overheat, they can die, get scattered. And if they're scattered, you may lose some. Okay, that's probably the kind of trouble that would impact the whole family. Now, and Joseph's a little boy, and he's going to go tell on his brothers who are a little bit older than he is. Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children because he was the son of his old age, and also because the son of his favorite wife. And so Joseph made him a long-sleeved robe with your Bible says many-colored robe. Everybody thinks many-colored. The Hebrew doesn't say many-colored. It's a royal robe, however. It's a robe that you'd give to somebody that had an office or prince or had dignity. It's not. It's. I always thought of a patchwork, beautiful patchwork kind of a robe. But it's just a dignified, royal-looking robe. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. That's kind of predictable, isn't it, knowing boys in a fallen world. And the youngest one tattles on them, and the older ones can't stand this extremely well-behaved, holier-than-thou brother. And he's got this really nice robe, and how come our father doesn't show us the same favoritism? And so that's the setting. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they only hated him the more. He said to them, this is something boys shouldn't do with their older brothers. You just don't do it. It's just not wise for your own safety. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him the more. He said to them, hear this dream which I have dreamed. Behold, we were all binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? They got the meaning right away that these sheaves of grain all tied up that represented the sons of Jacob, and there's this one sheaf, which Joseph stands up and takes charge, and they don't like that at all. Are you to have dominion over us? So they hated him yet more for his dreams and his words. He's known as a dreamer. He's as a boy. That's what he stands out as. He dreamed another dream and told it to his brothers, and he said, behold, I've dreamed another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. Oh, that's really arrogant, unless it's true. But when he told it to his father and his brothers, his father rebuked him. Well, you mean this boy is going to be over his father? More important than his father in the chain of authority eventually? What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and your brothers indeed come to bow down themselves before you? His brothers were jealous of him, and his father kept the saying in mind. His father ponders this. How could that ever come true? Does it come true? Yes, it does. Is there a mention of this in the last book of the Bible, in the book of Revelation? Yes, extra credit. Chapter 12. It takes this dream that John the apostle tells this dream again and explains how it came to be fulfilled in Joseph. So it's going to happen. Well, I won't read ahead, but you can if you want. Verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. Turns out that's the town where all the men were massacred by Dinah's brothers, and where they, but it's an empty town now. Nobody lives there, so it's safe to go back, and there aren't very many Canaanites living around there anymore. Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them. So without realizing that there's going to be trouble, Jacob sends Joseph to join his brothers at Shechem. And this obedient, well-behaved boy says, "Here I am." He said to him, "Go now, see if it's well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word again." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, that's way down south of Jerusalem, 50, 60 miles away. A man found him wandering in the fields, and a man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, I pray you, where they are pasturing the flock." I don't know who this man is, just some traveler. And the man said, "They have gone away. I've heard them say, 'Let us go down to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Dothan's about 15 miles more north than Shechem. It's just, you just keep going north and you'll come to the little town of Dothan. They saw him far off, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. So his brothers saw him coming down the hill, and they said, "We're going to get this kid. Kill him, murder." They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits." Actually, a cistern, that water cistern that fills with rainwater in the winter. Then we'll tell everybody that a wild beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. No way his dreams are going to be fulfilled if he's dead, and his body is in the bottom of this empty cistern. But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben's the oldest. He has still some leadership abilities, and he's supposed to look after all of his brothers, and he does, in a way. He doesn't want to see his young brother killed. "Shed no blood, cast him into the pit." But Reuben does agree to getting rid of him. So Reuben doesn't do all the rescuing that he should have at this point. When Joseph came to his brother, Reuben intended that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So as soon as the boys have moved on, "I'll go get my little brother out of the pit and take him home to dad." That's his plan, sort of. When Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and cast him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Would have been a different story if it had been the rainy season. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. So we know now that the Ishmaelites became travelers and traveling merchants. Already you get here the idea of a camel caravan going across the desert. In this case, it's going down to Egypt and carrying the typical things of gum and balm and myrrh. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him. He is our brother, our own flesh." His brothers heeded him. Besides, we'll get a little extra spending money this way. Get a good price for this handsome, young, strong slave. The Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit. Another caravan of Midianites. Who were they? They're related to the
Abraham's son.
Abraham's son by Keturah, his second wife. So the Midianites and the Ishmaelites are all kind of in the area, and they are all kind of compete with each other in a good way. So anyway, the Midianites get the kid up out of the pit, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Is that a good price? Not really. Later on in the law of Moses, that we have a price specified for slaves, extra credit, if anybody can guess. 30 shekels is what it is. Sold. So now Joseph is on his way to Egypt with the caravan, and his price is 30 shekels. A shekel is 4/10 of an ounce of silver. You can figure out that what that would turn out to be in today's silver. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he rent his clothes. He's horrified. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and killed a goat and dipped the robe in the blood, and they sent the long robe with sleeves and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." And he, that's Jacob, said, "It is my son's robe. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Jacob, age 107, rent his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol. I'm going to die and go to my destiny where my son is mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, very high up in the dynasty, in the court of Pharaoh. No confession by the brothers at this point. They didn't come clean with their dad. They could have solved it right then and there, couldn't they? Just tell their dad what really happened, bad as it was, because they're all involved in this. But they continued the lie and let their dad believe that Joseph is dead. Okay?
So why would Reuben say, "What am I going to do?" Did he have responsibility being the oldest?
Yes. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, it's on Reuben's the one that should have taken responsibility for the whole thing and come clean. But he's guilty along with them. I wonder what Jacob would have done if this real story had come out. It would have been heartbreaking for him.
It sort of points out the danger of not resisting evil completely. Yeah. So, well, I'll just do a modified plan that's not as bad, and then I can fix it afterwards. Versus just standing up at the very get-go, you sort of spiral out of control.
Yep, and we, the reader here, knows that we're seeing the fulfillment of what God told Abraham some years before, that the whole family is going to end up down in Egypt by some mechanism. This evidently is going to be the mechanism. Chapter 38. It happened. Anybody, you raise your hand, jump up and down. This is supposed to be a lively, riotous group here, of godly, everything but tongues. And you can do that if it's done biblically. Anyway, it happened at that time that Judah went down with his brothers. Who's Judah? Son number four. Okay, son of Leah. And the family doesn't have a lot to do when they're, except taking care of their animals. They're obviously growing barley and wheat now and along with raising the animals, and they need to do that to supplement the feed for the animals in the off season. So we have this now, a little incident. This interrupts the narrative of the story of what's going on with Joseph for a reason. It's interrupted, put in here for a good reason. At that time, Judah went down from his brothers and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. There, Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her and went in to her. She conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. Anything uncool there?
Yeah.
What's wrong?
Married a Canaanite woman.
We Jews do not intermarry with the Canaanites. That, remember that, what an argument that caused with Jacob and Esau and their mother and their parents? What a dispute when Esau took a foreign wife. The family should have remembered that lesson and paid attention to it. But that's he's bored. He's silly. He's 30 years old. He's not married. It's time to get married. So he just goes and marries this on his own. This girl, and her name is
Tamar.
And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," I've jumped a whole section. I can't do that. You can't do that with the soap operas on television. If you miss one, you're hopelessly lost. Verse 2. Wow. There Judah saw the daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. He married her and went in to her, and she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur. That means watchful. Again she conceived and bore a son and called his name Onan. Yet again she bore a son and called his name Shelah. She was in Chesbis when she bore him. And Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother." But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he spilled the semen on the ground, lest he should give offspring to his brother. And what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him also. Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up." She feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Now that's complicated. So I need somebody to rephrase this. Somebody tell us what's going on here. First thing happens is that Judah marries a Canaanite girl, and they have three sons, right? Okay. The first son
married Tamar.
And the Lord killed him. Didn't that sound awful? Why did the Lord kill him? Do you think? He's Canaanite. What do you think? Can you guess? Remember, we're dealing with God's people intermarrying with pagans. His lifestyle, he wasn't the least bit interested in the Lord or the things of the Lord. And long time went by. And the Hebrew would suggest, doesn't suggest that God went in with a knife and stabbed him. Allowed him to die is more than what the Hebrew arranged the circumstances so he died early. That takes some of the harshness out of it.
He had no line.
No, uh-huh. No, and he has no descendants. In that culture, there's something called the levirate marriage, which says, let's hear that.
If your brother dies without a child, then a brother has to marry that wife to.
Yes, if you end up with a widow someplace in the family,
yeah. And
you have another son, then you're, that second son is obligated to marry the widow. Is that okay? It's a tradition that later on got put into the law of Moses. It existed in the Middle East even before that. And so the next son, whose name is Onan, marries the widow, and he lives with her a long time, and every time they have intercourse, he refuses to consummate the intercourse, so the semen goes on the ground and is wasted, and she can't become pregnant. He cheats, and that's the sin of Onan is. It's this unwillingness to fulfill his wife's desire for a son, to leave her with offspring. So God says, enough of this, and kills him. Or allows him to die. Now what happens? We got one son left, and he knows what's going on, and he doesn't want any part of it, so he just ignores the problem and thinks it's going to go away. Well, that leaves this woman unmarried and twice widowed. And what happens to a woman who's twice married? And who's going to marry her? Nobody. She's just like a prostitute. She's just eventually or an old maid. That's just a bad thing in that culture. Yeah.
So it's not this form of birth control that is wicked.
No. No, it's not birth control. It's not masturbation. It's not. It's defrauding this woman of what she has a right to. Okay? Onanism is an ancient name for masturbation, which the old medical books around 1800 have, but this is not the real root problem. The root problem is defrauding when you have an obligation to marry somebody. Okay? Now, where did I stop? Verse 12?
12.
In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. And when Judah was comforted, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. He's got this Arab friend that he hangs out with. And when Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep," she put off her widow's garments and put on a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance to Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. She saw that Shelah was grown up, and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot. She had covered her face. He went over to her at the roadside and said, "Come, let me come into you." He did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Oh, this is really sneaky now, isn't it? Tamar's pretty clever. She's going to get her husband out of this somehow or other. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" So prostitutes always have a price, and she's pretending to be a prostitute, so she's going to pretend to have a price. And she says that he says, "I'll send you a kid from the flock. I'll send you a goat. As soon as I get back to my ranch, I'll send you a goat. Is that enough payment for our time together, our liaison?" And she says, "Yes, but I need some kind of a interim guarantee. Will you give me a pledge? I need a receipt. Will you give me a pledge to send you?" "What pledge shall I give you?" she replied. She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and went away, and taking off her veil, she put on her garments of her widowhood. So she's changed her disguise. She's back to her real self, and she's got Judah's signet and cord with an absolute, for sure, dead giveaway that it belongs to him. When Judah sent the goat by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he couldn't find her. And he asked the men of the place, "Where is the harlot who was at Enaim by the wayside?" She said, "No harlot is," they said, "no harlot has been here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I've not found her." And also the men of the place said, "No harlot has been here." Judah replied, "Let her keep the things as her own, lest we be laughed at. You see, I sent this goat, and you could not find her." He forgot about his signet. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. And moreover, she is with child by harlotry." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." He's the head of the family around in those parts, and he's going to just execute his own justice. As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." Let me identify the father here who got me pregnant. I'm the prostitute. And he holds up the signet and the cord. Judah acknowledged them and said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah. He did not lie with her again." So he came clean and humiliated in front of everybody there. But at least her life is spared. When the time of her delivery came, there were twins in her womb. Seems like we're getting another set of twins, and they always, some kind of trouble is going to come out of twins. And when she was in labor, one of the twins put out a hand, and a midwife took and bound on his hand a scarlet thread, saying, "This one came out first." But as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out, and she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." Therefore, his name was called Perez. So that's the should have been the second born. Afterward, his brother came out with the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Now, anything interesting about these boys? Well, Perez, it turns out that Perez, or the related word Peretz, means a breach, which is the kind of birth that's happening here, and some unusual breach. And this, later on, is used of the Messiah. And Micah talks about the Messiah is the Peretz, the breaker out, the shepherd who breaks open the sheepfold to take the sheep out safely. And that, you remember how the shepherd in ancient times would sit right at the gate of the sheepfold and lay his body across the entrance? No sheep could get out, no wild animals could come in. That's the Peretz, the Perez. And he comes out in the morning and leads the sheep. And in Micah's prediction, goes to the end of the age when Jesus will be the Peretz who leads the people of Israel as a flock to take possession of the land. Now, neat? Something else we know about Perez, those who've read ahead in the Bible. Some of you are probably going through the Bible first time.
He's in the genealogy of Matthew.
This is in the genealogy of in Matthew of
Jesus.
This is a relative. What's his genetic makeup? Well, he's a little bit Jewish, isn't he? He's half Jewish and half Canaanite or something like that. And he gets into the line of that leads to Jesus. Is that a mistake? No, it's not. That's just that great God we serve. Absolutely wonderful story. How God maneuvers around to get things done just the way he wants them. And I love that name, the Perez. It's a common name in Israel today. See, who's the president of Israel? Perez, yeah. The president, not the prime minister. The breaker forth. Okay. Are we about out of time? We're about out of time, I think. Do you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, rebuttals?
Eliphaz. Well, whether he was the Eliphaz in the book of Job.
Could be.